Okay, well, it's probably useful to have that particular passage open in front of you. If you want to check that commandment is, you shall not commit adultery, then it's Exodus 20 and the seventh commandment. But it just looks a bit daft having someone stand up to do the reading, say, you shall not commit adultery, and then sit down again. Adultery, as all the sins in the Ten Commandments, is obviously something tremendously important to God. The proof of that, if we needed it, is in the second part of the reading that Tim just gave us, verse 31 onwards. We're not actually going to look at this in detail because it throws up lots more issues. But just to say this, adultery is the only grounds explicitly given in the Bible by which you can then divorce. Now, by implication, we've covered this before, so I don't want to say too much now. By implication, I think there are other grounds, but the only one that's really explicit that you can just read off the pages of Scripture is adultery. Now, if you know anything about the Bible, you'll know how seriously God takes marriage. So the fact that there is a grounds for breaking that covenant, that bond that he created, well, shows just how serious he must think that particular sin is. As I say, no more on divorce today, but it just highlights the seriousness, if we did need it, of the seventh commandment. Now, as soon as you start talking about anything to do with sex, then I guess if you're new to church things, your suspicion will be that the church, Christians, the Bible are going to be against whatever it might be. So the classic view of Christians, obviously in the culture, it is that they are against sex. But just think about this. Apparently next Friday night, I think, or Saturday night, there's going to be a concert in Darley Abbey Park when The Flame comes to town. You're going to have a classical orchestra on stage playing away, whatever they're doing, Beethoven or Mozart. If you were to jump up, okay, in the middle, they're playing their sonatas, whatever. If you were to jump up with your recorder and just start tooting away, and then your friend jumps up next, he's brought his own trombone, he just sort of starts breaking into, you know, the Johnny Briggs theme tune, you know, another friend, Dave's brought his drums down, starts whacking away, and the people next to you stood up and complained, would it be a justifiable answer on your behalf to turn to the people who are complaining at you bashing around and blowing away and saying, hey, you guys complaining, you're so anti-music? Of course not. Of course not. If you're against, just because you're against the abuse of something, doesn't mean you're against the thing itself. And so it is with the Bible and sex, or with God and sex. He is against the abuse of sex, the misuse of sex, but he is not against the gift itself. Of course he isn't. He invented it. Now, if you go along to the National Gallery and take on your crayons and draw a moustache on the Mona Lisa, add a few sunflowers in, to the rest of the paintings, does that mean you're pro-art? Somehow you've got a better attitude to art than the person who says, no, you must not touch those things. Well, no. Just because you think there are limits and controls, there is a context in which a gift is to be enjoyed, doesn't mean you are against that thing. And so it is with sex. The first command given to humans in the Bible, the very first command, even before pray or worship God, is go forth and multiply, go and have sex. There's a whole book of the Bible, Song of Songs, just about sex. It's the entire book. I did some teenage Bible reading notes given to me by the teacher through whom I became a Christian at school. And they went through every book of the Bible and they saved the Song of Songs to last. And just before you got to it, there was a little note in the notes saying, given that most of the readers of these notes will be teenagers, you might not be grown enough up enough to read these yet, so perhaps skip it. It is explicitly about sex. There may be more in there. We'll maybe come to it another time. But it is basically, at least for 1,000 years BC, pretty explicit. An enjoyment, a celebration of sex. Sex is good, but it has a context. And the context, of course, if you know anything about the Bible, is that it's between a man and a woman in marriage. A man and a woman in marriage. Now, already, as soon as you even say that actually sex is just between two people, already lots of people around will be thinking, well, that's very restrictive. Okay, sex is fun, sex brings great pleasure, so surely, you know, you want to have as many partners as you can. It's certainly what the world tells us, isn't it? The sort of lads' mags. You know, how many have you scored? The chat in the common room, even as young as school age, certainly by the time you get to university or into your 20s or whatever, how the ultimate embarrassment. You're still a virgin at 20-whatever? One person compared it to buying a record. How dull would it be, they said, if you just bought one record and played it over and over again? Or similarly, how dull would it be just to marry one person and just sleep with that same person over and over again? The reply in that particular debate came from a Christian I thought was a good one. And he said to the person, look, you're making completely the wrong analogy. You shouldn't compare relationships and sex to buying a record and just playing it over and over again. Of course that would be dull. Instead, compare an exclusive relationship to buying an instrument and learning to play it. And over the years, as you go on and on and on, you get better and better, you get closer and closer together, more and more harmonious, you can make better and better music. That is the biblical picture of relationships, of marriage, and ultimately of sex. And so when we come to the seventh commandment, you shall not commit adultery, God takes it incredibly seriously. But as we see in these verses, he never meant it to be just restricted to someone sleeping with someone who is not their wife or husband. Yeah, that's the technical definition of adultery, isn't it? I mean, technically, you can't commit adultery unless you're married. Okay, so for, I don't know, three quarters of the room, half the room, it's impossible for you to commit adultery. It's very unlikely, though, that God would give one of the 10 big rules and only make it applicable to, whatever, half the population of the world. And as Jesus explains in these verses 27 to 30 of Matthew's Gospel, actually, the do not commit adultery, if you like, is just the headline. It's like the title of the book, and the book is God's guidelines for our sex lives. And the depth of it that he reveals goes far beyond adultery. So verse 28, I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Do not commit adultery means don't lust, says Jesus. And suddenly the field's got a lot wider, hasn't it? I read the other day that at least in 2010, the porn industry was bigger than Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Apple, Yahoo, and eBay combined. That's an extraordinary figure, isn't it? The porn industry bigger than Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, Google, Yahoo, and eBay combined. It is a massive, massive industry. All aimed at simulating, promoting, well, breaking the seventh commandment. But of course, actually, the society we live in nowadays is far more geared towards breaking that commandment than just the sort of explicit top-shelf magazines or the hardcore websites. We break the commandment, this lusting commandment, not just when we buy things labelled as pornography, but when we flick through the TV channels late at night and end up on the film. And it's not a porn film, but we know it's going to have a good deal of sex in it. We break it actually when we take a second look at the pretty secretary in the office, or the pretty boss. We break it when we flick through our friends' Facebook photos and sort of concentrate on the holiday snaps. We break it any time, even just mentally, we are going beyond a friendship with a person of the opposite sex, mentally undressing, mentally creating scenarios. Now, it's not wrong, I would say, it's not wrong to have a sex drive. God made us that way. It's not wrong to be attracted to someone. But the difference between looking at someone, if you're a guy, the difference between looking at someone and thinking they're attractive and looking at someone and lusting, I would say is about a second. Maybe a second and a half. That's the difference. Appreciating beauty, well, that's not necessarily wrong. But you know pretty quickly when it goes beyond that and enters the imagination. Lust is a breach of this seventh commandment. And fairly obviously too then, so is all sorts of sex that is outside that context of marriage. Often in the Bible, depending what version you've got, you'll get a word like fornication. Good old sounding word. Kind of word a preacher can thunder. Fornication. Fornicators. All fornication means, sometimes in more modern versions, it's just translated sexual immorality. It's a word, porneia, in Greek, from which we get pornography. It just means any type of sexual activity or sexual misconduct outside of that one-to-one male-female marriage bond. So if you're not married and you start sleeping with your girlfriend, you're not technically committing adultery, you are committing fornication in the Bible's understanding. And all of them are ruled offside in this commandment. Now, I don't want to spend much time or any more time at least, sort of outlining why these things are bad. I think with sexual sins in particular, then we just know they are wrong. We know adultery is wrong. We can see the damage it causes, both to the injured party, the left behind party, to the children, to the wider family, to the community. If we're lusting, we just know it's wrong. You don't have to convince people that lusting and pornography is wrong. I could spend 25 minutes and really whip up the guilt, but basically the result will be the same. We know they're offside. That's not the problem. The problem is not knowing they're wrong. The problem is dealing with them, isn't it? All of us. And I've got to say, this is male and female. Tim Chester, who works up in Sheffield, has written a great book on struggling with pornography. And one of the things he makes clear really early on is that it's not just a male problem. He says when he addressed it in his church, he always spoke as if it was just guys who struggled. Only guys struggle with lust. Only guys struggle with pornography. And it was in speaking to some of his congregation afterwards, and particularly one or two females who came up and said, no, it's our problem too. And it's so depressing hearing it talked about as if it's only a male problem, because it makes us feel like complete weirdos. Clearly, it is not restricted to one sex. There are no commandments that are unisex. Well, sorry, they're all unisex. There's no commandments that are aimed at just one sex. So the question we need to move to is why? Why are we so driven to break these commandments, and this one in particular, do not commit adultery? I mean, the obvious reason, of course, is pleasure, isn't it? We like the thrill of sex. God has created sex as good. He's created it as enjoyable, as pleasurable. That's a very obvious reason why we indulge, either mentally or literally. But even beyond that, I think we can go further. Some people, when they abandon their wife or their husband, it's not actually just for the pleasure of sex. For some, it's romance. We tell ourselves, I've got to be loved. I've got to find someone who loves me, who really looks up to me. I want to have that sort of special in-love feeling back, and frankly, it's died with my husband, so I'll find it somewhere else. Why am I driven to go outside my marriage? Because I need to be loved. That's what I really need. For others, and maybe this is more male, I don't know, there's a sort of power thing going on. Why am I chasing the sort of younger colleague at work? Well, I want to show that I've still got it. I'm still a big player. I'm still attracted for ladies. And it's not necessarily there's anything wrong at home. It's just that, well, I want to play the field. I want to show I'm just as sort of strong and powerful and desirable as I was at 25. Now I'm 45 or 55. For others, it's simply the thrill of the chase. They'll never quite go through with it. They'll never actually commit adultery, actually sleep with the person. But the lights know the sort of options around. They like the sort of flirting, the sort of air of, well, who knows, that drifts around. Still others, when you hear testimonies of people who've committed adultery, basically are arguing they deserve it. You know, I deserve it. I work hard every day. I've got a stressful job. My wife, well, she's let herself go. She's not sleeping with me enough. She's not providing the kind of home attitude that I deserve, so I've got the right to go and find my desires elsewhere. It's an outrageous way to argue. And yet it is one that is used, isn't it? And in fact, all those go just as much for sex between non-married people or for pornography and lust as they do for adultery, strictly defined. So what do you do? What do you do? We know it's a problem, but what do you do? It's interesting, there's obviously a debate on at the moment about who can get married in the UK, and particularly can two people of the same sex get married. I'm not going to go into that now, but one of the things that gets thrown up is that actually to say no to that is just an old-fashioned way. You know, in the olden days, of course, everyone thought homosexual marriage was wrong, but nowadays we're more enlightened. The problem with that, or one of the problems with that argument itself, is that if it was always assumed that homosexuality was wrong, if it was always known and everyone back in history or whatever, or back in the biblical days, just sort of agreed it was wrong, there'd be no need to have any commands about it in the Bible. Okay, Paul, or in the New Testament, or Jesus, or Moses in the Old Testament, doesn't bother issuing commands about things that aren't a problem. The reason he bothers to write, do not engage in homosexual acts, to quote Paul in 1 Corinthians 6, the reason that it's outlawed in the Old Testament is because the people needed to know it was wrong. If everyone just, oh, of course I'd never do that, well, no point giving a command. This battle with sex, the battle with the misuse of sex, has been one that's gone on, of course, throughout history, from Adam in the garden onwards. There's a guy called Oregon. He was born in the late 100s. So I think he was born about 185, lived into the from end of the second into the third century AD. And he was a church leader. Okay? He was a big-name guy. He helped develop the doctrine of the Trinity. You know, his books have still survived 1,800 years later. And he really struggled with lust in particular. And he knew his Bible. He'd read this passage, verse 27. You've heard it was said, do not commit adultery. But I say to you, if you even look at a woman with lustful intent, you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. And so he read the next verse. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out, throw it away. Better to lose one of your members than the whole body to be thrown into hell. He reasoned it through and castrated himself. Great church leader, castrated himself so that he would not commit adultery, and at least in his intent, so he would not lust. Around the same guy, a guy called Tertullian, who's probably an even greater figure. He's a sort of more orthodox figure. And one time, the story is told of him that he was praying and he was tempted. This time he was tempted by an image of a woman from his past coming back to him. It's not quite clear from the account whether it's someone he'd maybe slept with before he was a Christian or whether it's just a beautiful woman he knew. And anyway, the temptation to lust after this woman came into his mind. And so what did he do? He was battling. He was on the bout to give way when he ripped off his clothes and threw himself into a patch of nettles and briars and rolled around in it. When he got up, his skin was torn and bleeding, and his desire was gone. I wonder what you think of those two. Oregon castrating himself, and Tertullian whipping off his clothes and diving into a patch of nettles. I mean, your first reaction is to snigger, isn't it? Or possibly just think, what a bunch of weirdos. Of course the methods are wrong, okay? Let me just make that really clear. Of course that is not a right way of dealing with these desires. But let me just say this. They did understand that sin was serious. Before we laugh at them, and before we rightly point out where they went wrong, because they did go wrong, we've got to recognise that their motivation was actually admirable. Their motivation is far better than ours, actually. Their desire to kill sin is far greater than ours. Now, these guys knew that Jesus had died for them. And they knew that he paid for our penalty on the cross, paid for our sins. They knew they were going to heaven. They knew it was grace alone that saved us. And yet, they still fought tooth and nail against their sin. And that attitude is exactly right. Nowhere in the Bible do you see anyone reason, Jesus has paid for our sins, he's died for it, it's all gone, so hey, whatever, sin away. Doesn't matter. No, because he's died for us, and because actually he's broken the power of sin, because if you're a Christian you no longer have to sin, Paul and everyone else reasons, therefore kill sin, attack it. Fighting sin is not passive, it doesn't just sort of happen. People who are older here will tell you, you don't just sort of accidentally get holier as you get older. If the older members of the congregation here are holier, it's because they fought for it and worked for it. Sadly, in churches, and I'm sure it won't be true here, but sadly in some churches, it's not the case that the older people are holier. And when they're not, when the older generation is not holier, presuming they've been Christians longer, well, something's gone wrong, more or less. We should be making progress. We'll never get there. We're never going to hit perfection. We're never going to be pure as snow in our actual lives on earth. We will do in heaven, but not on earth. But the fact that you're not going to get there fully doesn't mean you don't try. You will make progress. But how? How? How do we move from having the right desire to actually seeing some fruit? Let me say this. I think the reason that we don't make progress, particularly in battling sexual sins, whether it's adultery itself, literally, or whether it's the lust or the sex of other wrong situations, the reason I think we do it is because we've taken on the cultural view of marriage around us, when actually the Bible is crystal clear. Okay, the Bible is crystal clear that you shall not have more than two husbands. Okay, no more than two. One is fine. Two for some, but not for everybody. Three, you're in trouble. Okay, two max. It's massively clear in the Old Testament. It's less clear in the New, but it's there. And the cure to all these sexual sins, actually, is found in fully appreciating your first husband. If you fully appreciate your first husband, if you can do that, if you can really see what's great about him, then actually the desires to go elsewhere will fade. You won't need to go elsewhere to find love, to make yourself feel still loved. You won't need to go elsewhere to make you feel important or desirable. You won't need even to go elsewhere to get your kicks, to get pleasure. You won't even necessarily need to take on a second husband. Now, before you head for the door or start throwing rocks, let me explain. Marriage in the Bible is created as a picture of the relationship between God and his people. Okay, marriage in the Bible is created as a picture of the relationship between God and his people. That means that if you're a Christian, you are married. Done. You are married if you're a Christian. That's why I said two max. I'm not encouraging bigamy. Okay, you can't have two human husbands. One max. But if you've got one human husband, you must remember you've also got one divine husband. In Jeremiah 2 and verse 2, God looks back through his prophet Jeremiah. He looks back at the Exodus, the story during which the Ten Commandments were given. And God says, chiding the Israelites, I remember the devotion of your youth, your love as a bride, and how you followed me in the wilderness. This giving of the Ten Commandments, the giving of the law, the cloud comes down, you remember the story. It's almost pictured as a marriage when Israel married God. And through the Old Testament, there's all sorts of references, we won't go through them. Through the Old Testament, Israel, God's people, are often described as the bride of God. God is the husband and Israel is the bride. And that's why when we get to the New Testament, Jesus describes himself as the bridegroom. We don't often use the word bridegroom anymore, it just means groom, like the husband, if you like. In one occasion early on, in all the Gospels, actually, apart from John, a debate kicks out because Jesus' disciples aren't fasting. The disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, the Sadducees are fasting, the Essenes are fasting. But Peter and John and Andrew and Simon, all the rest of them, they're not fasting. And so the Pharisees, the religious leaders, come and say, why aren't your disciples fasting? And Jesus says, how can they fast when the bridegroom is with them? Who's the bridegroom? There's no groom. None of them are engaged. None of them were, they may have been married, but not that we know of. Who's the groom? Jesus is the groom. And so that picture from the Old Testament of Israel being married to God transfers into the New Testament as the people of God, so the church, who are now not just Israelites, not just Jews, but also Gentiles, the rest of us. We are married to God. You'll know the pictures from Ephesians, perhaps, or Revelation, even. And I think I sometimes wonder about this as Christians. I've been thinking about this week, obviously. I sometimes wonder, particularly myself, actually, if I see this picture of Jesus marrying the church, God marrying his bride, really just as a way of getting rules for marriage. So in Ephesians 5, if you want to flick onto that, just to sort of give you an example of one of the passages I'm talking about. It's on page 1178. In fact, 177 is probably easier. 1177. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 22. And Paul turns to instructions for husbands and wives. Wives, submit to your husbands, your own husbands, no, not just to any man, but to your own husband, as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. So also the church submits to Christ, as wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Verse 25 over the page, husbands, love your wives, as Christ loved the church. You see the parallel going on again. The church is the bride. Christ is the husband. And from that passage, you can validly take various principles for marriage. Husbands, you're to love your wife just as Christ loved the church. So I take it that means we're to give up our lives for our wives when called. We're to lead our marriages in a way that leads to holiness. Christ, what does he do? He washes the church, as the passage goes on. Wives, you're to submit to your husbands, just as the church submits to Christ. Why do Christian wives submit? Not because their husbands are greater or better or something. It's because they're modelling this relationship. Now, all those things are true. All those things are true. This pattern does give us rules for our marriages, but what it also does is tell us about God. It reveals things to us about God, about the gospel. It's a picture of the gospel, the good news of Christianity. What it tells us is that any human marriage, the best marriage ever, okay? I don't even know who nowadays we would look up to as the ideal married couple. Posh and Becks. I don't know. The Queen and Prince Philip. Depends who you are. Whoever your ideal married couple is, even the greatest marriage is nothing like the relationship between God and his people. That means, let's just ground that a bit more. That means if you're single, so you're a girl now and you're single, you find Brad Pitt lookalike, who knows his Bible back to front, is full of the Spirit, he prays every morning, who is zealous in evangelism, who is incredibly humble, who is also a stockbroker and earns many millions a year. That relationship is not going to be as good as the relationship between you and God. Now, do we believe that? Do we believe that? We don't, do we? Guys, just reverse it. And it's the same. If we're single and we don't believe that, what will happen? We'll run around endlessly trying to find a girlfriend or a boyfriend. Because actually all my needs are, I need to be loved. I need the pleasure of sex. I need someone to look up to me, to esteem me. All my needs, they've not been met because they've not been met in God. God is not enough for me. If I don't really appreciate him, that's why I said earlier that the answer to all these problems is not just physical stuff, you know, slapping an internet filter on the computer, or the answer is in appreciating what you've got. This picture of Christ and the church, the marriage, is all we could need, God is saying. The reality is God and us. The picture, the little sort of image, is us and the church. And so if we're single, and we complain that we haven't been given the picture, we haven't been given a wife or a husband, and yet we've got the reality, well, something's gone horribly wrong in our understanding of our relationship or our enjoyment of our relationship with God. It's like a child who's promised on his 18th birthday, on your 18th birthday, I'm going to give you a Jag, okay? An E-Type Jag, a beautiful green sports car. This is what I wanted on my 18th birthday. I knew I wasn't going to get it. That's what you're going to get. And so on the 18th birthday, the son is presented with a Jaguar. Perfect working condition, everything you could desire, the dream car. But he sulks. Why is he sulking? Father takes him aside. What is it, sonny? I've given you everything. I thought this is exactly what you wanted. Yeah. But my next door neighbour's got that, and he's also got a little model Jag. Yeah, one of those little Tonka toys that sort of races along the... You can push it along the tabletop, and you haven't given me one of those. You don't really love me. How am I going to survive in the world? I've just got a sports car, but I haven't got a little Tonka toy. I haven't got the model. Well, simply, and I know it's hard being single. I know it's hard. But the answer to the problem is not just to chuck away all principles and grab the first girl that'll have you. The answer, too, is not to compromise on the things that God tells you. If God tells you, it is male, female. Rule one. God tells you not to marry a close relative. Rule two. God tells you must marry a Christian. Rule three. God tells you must marry someone who is not already married. Rule four. After that, no more rules. Over to you. Just be sensible. Be wise. You will chuck those principles in if you're not satisfied with what you've got in God. But actually, he is offering you all those things. He's not stingy or tight. He will give you all those things. So what you really need if you're struggling with not having the marriage is more of him. Now, he may also give you the model. You may get the Tonka toy as well to play with for 50, 60, 70 years until we die, and then in heaven, well, we're not going to be married anyway. But he may not. Up to him. Similarly, if we're married, it's also really important to get this, if we're married, we fight that the battle to commit adultery, either mentally or physically, with exactly the same thing. Your wife, your human wife or husband, is your second partner. And unless you're spending enough time and enjoying your first partner, then actually it's going to be very tough to stay faithful, mentally, at least, to your second partner. You see, because we're made in the image of God, the closest thing, and I've said this before, the closest thing to God in your life is another human being. Human beings are made in the image of God, so they're incredibly powerful. They do pull us in. You'll know the tug of love or the tug of sexual attraction. Or it's hard, isn't it? And because it's so easy to take your wife and put her on a pedestal, it's also very easy for her to just push God off. And when that happens, when they are the number one person in your life, if you're married, you're in trouble. Because actually you were created to have God as number one. Now God, for instance, is omniscient. He knows everything. So he will always understand you. Okay, you come from home from work, it's been a terrible day, awful. You try and talk to your husband and he's just trying to watch the TV over your shoulder or the football's on, or you try and explain it, he doesn't get it. God always gets it. He's omniscient. He understands. If you expect your husband to be omniscient, you're in trouble, as I guess you've discovered. God is all-powerful. Your husband will be able to help you with certain problems. But he is not all-powerful. He can't magic money out of thin air. He can't protect you from illness. He certainly can't get you through death. And so if you start looking to him to be your saviour, you're in trouble. In fact, it will actually stress your marriage, because you're looking to him to be the Messiah, him to be the one that provides everything, when together, actually, you should be looking to God. Even pleasure, let me come back to pleasure. Even pleasure is the same battle. And again, whether you're married or not married, the desire basically for sex, the desire for orgasm, even that, we've got to remember, it is a revelation from God, not just a command. If everything reveals God, if sex is meant to reveal God, then why has he given us the gift of sex that brings such pleasure? Well, there's all sorts of things about binding people together and all the rest, producing children, obviously. But one of the reasons it's so pleasurable, God could have made sex just, like eating or something, just not particularly pleasurable, we just kind of do it, or breathing. He could have made a way of making children that's just all dull, but he made a great way of making children. And he also commanded that sex doesn't just have to be for making children, it's just a gift. Why? Why did he make it so pleasurable? Well, go back. What is the point of this sex in marriage? What's the point of marriage? It's to tell us about the relationship between God and us. So part of the point of making sex so pleasurable is to say, actually, the reality is even more pleasurable. Okay, even sex is a revelation of what God is offering to us. The pleasures of knowing him. The image, remember, is lesser. Just as your marriage is lesser, the intimacy is lesser. Everything is lesser in the picture. The donkotoi. The reality is much greater. If you've been learning your memory verses, Psalm 16:11. Someone don't impress me. Anyone know Psalm 16:11? No, wait. I'm not going to wait. Psalm 16:11. You lead me in paths of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand there are pleasures forevermore. The real pleasures aren't just found in sex. Sex is a revelation of even greater pleasures that will be found ultimately in heaven or in the new world with God. In a sense, we're sort of engaged, I suppose. But that's the way to fight the lure of porn or lust. The lure of the pretty girl or the handsome guy. It's not just to say this is bad, I must not do it, because it just doesn't work. It's to say that it is even better, there is more pleasure in God. That's why Paul can say in Galatians 2:20, another one of our memory verses, I won't even ask, the life I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. He even said, again, same verse, it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. How does he fight? He doesn't fight by rules. Remember the seventh commandment. He lives by faith. He fights by faith in the Son of God. By faith. Faith comes from hearing the word. That is how you fight. That's why we put actually Psalm 16:11 in there. at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. So that the advert pops up on the screen, or it's late at night and I'm alone and I can get away with it, or and I fight back. The verse is there, hidden in my heart. If I'm satisfied in the first partner, who has offered me everything, then actually the second partner, well, I can resist. If you're not a Christian, this is what you need. A marriage is a good thing. Sex is a good thing in marriage. But if you're not a Christian, what you're missing out on is not just a free pass to heaven or forgiveness or skin sin scratched off, although it is all those things. It is also the relationship with the greatest person in existence. A guy who does a lot of youth work wrote this: when sex becomes redemptive, i.e. when sex becomes a thing that's going to save us, it's no shock that those hungry for heaven will feast but never be filled. Is that you? If you're looking to sex or relationships to answer your problems when it's only the picture, the tonka toy, you can feast, you can have sleep with as many girls as you can, many boyfriends as you like, but you'll never be filled. Because actually what you really need is not the tonka toy, but the reality, God. When you feast there, again, final memory verse, I'm the bread of life. Whoever believes in me will never be hungry. Whoever comes to me will never thirst. That is the good news of the gospel. It's the good news that fuels the fight against sin, and it's the great promise that actually it will end in ultimate joy.